From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Midnight Movie Cowboys and the World of Tomorrow. I am your trusty captain, Hunter Deucing, and with me is plucky reporter, who is smarter than me, but and is more gutsy, Mr. John Grace. Say hello, John.
Hello, everybody from Colorado land.
Yeah.
From the mighty Rocky Mountains.
Yes, I'm down in Dallas where it's just kind of hot, and you probably have great weather up there.
Yeah, actually, it's been pretty nice this week.
Ugh, I hate you.
But you know, like Elmore Leonard says, never talk about the weather. It's bad, right?
Yeah, it is, and it's bad small talk, too.
Yeah, it's the worst.
It's terrible.
Next time somebody wants to talk to you about the weather, just say, go away, cuck.
Talk about real shit or get the fuck out of here, you cuck.
Exactly, for those of you who are joining the Proud Boys.
Yes, Uhuru.
Mm-hmm. Proud of your boy. All right.
Yeah. Anyway, so John and I, Stuart's not here. He's on vacation. He's on holiday. I think he's back by now, but you know, couldn't prep.
Yeah, I think he found out about the Brexit yesterday.
Yeah, I think he did too. He was very pleased.
Yeah.
Yes. Very pleased to see England, you know, possibly saying goodbye to the European Union.
Yeah.
Anyway,
it's a potential. Gone, you know, the EU might be doomed now. So.
Oh, that they want to? Don't they want to form like a European superstate?
Supposedly,
they're I saw it on InfoWars. So who knows?
Yeah. Oh, buy gold, seeds. You know,
buy gold. The pound is falling.
I don't believe too much of what I see on there. Like 2%, I might believe, but you know
Alex Jones is one of those guys you tune in sometimes and you go, oh, that's interesting. Okay, this is pretty good.
Yeah.
And you listen for a bit, and then he just will go off into an air, and you're like, whoa.
Yeah, he completely like knocks over the dominoes or the house of cards. It doesn't take long. He'll just say something about suicidal shrimp, and it's over.
Yep. Spider goats.
Spider goat. Chemicals in the water. Suicidal shrimp. Shrimps are getting up on the land and dying. It's in the papers. You can Google it. And it's just like, it's like, wow, you were so intelligent for a while. You were giving like Rush Limbaugh a run for his money and bringing this new conservatism energy in, and then you just blew it.
Yeah,
because you go into science fiction land, and
yeah,
it's like,
he kind of seems a little too emotionally unstable. Like,
well, you know, he's Bill Hicks.
He is Bill Hicks.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to just go ahead and say I subscribe to that theory.
I'm starting to think he is. Yeah. I really think there's something there.
Like, you know, I have a friend who's a big Bill Hicks fan, and I posted this meme of Bill Hicks and Alex Jones side by side, which is alarmingly similar.
It is. And, no, it's frightening. But the funniest thing is I have one of our crazy Colorado stations, the types that they carry like militia radio and stuff. They carry the Alex Jones show in the afternoons, and I can sometimes pick them up when I'm driving to Colorado Springs. And I just noticed every time that I tuned in, he always had Roger Stone on.
Really?
He's always like, Roger Stone is on the show today. And then he'll talk to Roger Stone. It's about Trump poll. He's become a big Trump guy.
Yeah.
Alex Jones has. And then he'll have Roger Stone on. And then when Roger Stone leaves, because Stone doesn't really talk about the crazy stuff, then he's like, he was in the Nixon White House, and he's also an expert on JFK conspiracies. I've talked to him about that. He doesn't believe the traditional story. He believes in the alternative views. You know, it's like, but Stone never says any of this when he's on Jones's show. But it's like he's trying to make an excuse for being a Trump cheerleader.
Yes.
By saying, oh, but you know, Roger Stone, he knows about the JFK conspiracies. But
my favorite Alex Jones impression, by the way, Anthony Cumia. Alex Jones.
Yeah, he gets it. He does this kind of nasally thing with him. Alex Jones.
But he has Alex on his show. It's pretty funny.
I think I might have been the first person to do an Alex Jones impression.
Yeah,
years ago.
Richard Lococo.
Yeah, Richard Lococo. I listened to him for like a month before I did that impression, and nailed it, I think.
Yeah.
You know, but I haven't I haven't listened to him enough in years to even do that impression anymore, so I don't.
Are the Dark Truth Seekers still a thing?
No, that got pulled because, you know, the guy who ran the old show decided he didn't want any evidence of his old show anywhere.
Yeah, it's pod-fated.
Right, so I mean, he had control of the Lococo Twitter account, so he pulled it, so I just let the character die.
Nah.
So, although I could bring the character back,
It's a good character, but not as good as the fascist guy.
No, yeah, I preferred doing that character, and most people didn't know that was me.
Yeah, you fascist!
Yeah, what did I call that guy? I don't even remember his name.
I don't remember his name either, but he was like a Colorado biker guy. Not biker, but bicycler.
He was a Colorado cyclist. What did I call it? He had a real pretentious name, and I don't even remember it, but he was like the fascist. He was based on somebody I knew.
Yeah, I remember you telling me that.
Michael Pettyman. That was his name. Wasn't that it? It was Michael, and Michael was spelled M-Y-K-A-L. And that was my favorite character, because I could improv him, and old host of the old show could play along really well.
Yeah.
And I thought that was way funnier than Lococo.
Yeah, because, I remember listening to that and just laughing my leg off going.
But nobody really, because I had really worked on, he was an original character. I mean, when he's based on your friend, it's more original than basing him on some popular, or at the time, Alex Jones was a cult personality.
Yeah, Alex Jones wasn't as well known then as he is now.
No, now it would be as funny because everybody's doing Alex Jones impressions, but back then, nobody was, because he wasn't that popular. He was just only known to conspiracy whack jobs, and I had to be told about him. I didn't keep up with that stuff.
I think the biggest exposure Alex Jones had had up to that point was his appearance in the movie Waking Life.
Waking Life, and I think he had chased, who's the right wing, Michelle Malkin.
Mm.
He had chased her down the street at some Denver political rally thing.
Really?
Yeah, there was an incident, and he made a few headlines doing that. But because nobody wanted to talk about Michelle Malkin and give her publicity, it wasn't really widespread. But yeah, he had some incident with her. And then I spoofed it with Lococo claiming that he had chased Debbie Schlissel. So,
by the way, this is a movie podcast. And if you want to see the most batshit fucking crazy movie reviews ever, read Debbie Schlissel. I mean, it is all like, she's like, I give this movie 5 Reagans, it's outstanding, or this movie gets 5 Obamas and 5 Osamas, it's terrible. and all of her things are read through whether or not it, you know, like all film criticism today is the movie racist, is the movie sexist, gender studies, sexual politics, blah blah blah, fucking who cares. Hers is all, is the movie anti-Semitic or not? And she will find anti-Semitism in the most fucking... She makes the social justice warriors look like they can't find shit. She will take anything and spin it as an anti-Israel thing.
Anything that's interpreted as anti-Israel is odd. It might be the most innocuous comment, and it's just, she will pick up on it. It was just like, and go, oh, this gets 5 Marxes, 4 Obamas, 3 Bin Ladens.
You could see somebody going like, yeah, Hasids are weird, and she'd be like, she'd say that they're like Zog.
Hey, I didn't have a good time in Israel last year. Ah! Got you.
You support the funny Palestine. Thing,
I just realized, like, when I was doing the Michael Pettyman character, how I was predicting the online behavior of a lot of far lefties on Facebook, and this wasn't really the case years ago, because my theory was he was based on a friend of mine who was very left-wing, was even a member of the Communist Party, and acted like he was all for peace, but he was the most short-tempered, angry, violent person.
Oh, is he kind of like...
So willing to jump into a fight. I mean, he really was. Like, I saw him try to, like, intimidate people at, like, a bowling alley punk rock show. He was just like, man, he was just like, for Mr. Peace and Love, he was just so eager to swing fists. So I based Pettyman on that, where he would be, like, talking about peace and love. Just, hey, come on, man, you want to fight? Huh? Because that's the way he was.
It kind of reminds me of that runner dude who runs up and starts screaming at that protester in the street. Did you ever see that video? He's like this spindly runner guy who looks like a skinny Andrew Breitbart, but he's a ginger. And he's running in place the whole time. And he just, and he like loses his shit on this guy just standing there in the street with a sign. He's like,
right.
You guys are the anti-Semites. You hate homosexuals. You hate liberals. You hate everybody. And he's like screaming in the street and running in place the whole time.
like in these little shorts.
Wow.
It reminded me of that guy.
it's something in the wiring. It's people that need to do some Tai Chi.
Yeah.
You know, they need to chill out. Need to chill out, man.
Spend some time with the heavy bag, you know.
Have some tea, do some Tai Chi, maybe work on the Wing Chun dummy, you know.
So, speaking of chilling out.
Yeah.
The movie we chilled out and watched.
Yeah.
Sky Captain and the World of Tomorrow. 2004, directed by Kerry Conran.
Mm-hmm.
And written by Kerry Conran. And his brother, Kevin, was the designer on the movie, if I'm not mistaken. This is a movie that I remember seeing commercials for all the time in 2004. Very hyped. A lot of people, well, at least it was at my school. Like, a lot of people were excited to see it. And then it sort of died.
Yeah.
When it came out.
I saw it at a half. I went to see it on the biggest screen in Colorado at the time. And the theater was like, it was a Sunday night. And the theater was like, probably, God, I don't know, maybe a fourth full or a third full. It was kind of like, oh, I was hoping this would, you know, by the end of the film, I was like, well, I was hoping this had drawn a bigger crowd, but.
Well, and it was sort of ahead of its time. I mean, a lot of people think George Lucas was the guy who started the shooting an entire movie on green screen.
Yeah.
But really, it was this movie.
Yeah, it really was. Because I think he was working on this even before The Phantom Menace was released.
Yeah. Yeah,
and The Phantom Menace still had location filming.
It did.
I didn't sit through it a second time, so I couldn't tell you for sure, but I think it actually had some location filming.
It does Tatooine. Most of Tatooine, like the city parts of Mos Espa, are practical effects. You even see a lot of practical aliens in it.
Right.
Like the only one of the, like, not the only one, I shouldn't say that, but like the Jar Jar Binks was like the big experiment. We're going to have an all-digital character.
Right.
You know, and you have a few others in there. You have an all-digital, like Jabba the Hutt and the announcers and the pod race people and all that. But it had a lot more practical effects than people remember. Mm-hmm. Like, they did location work in that movie. Attack of the Clones, I think, was the first one to be all
like
green screen.
All green screen, yeah. This one, it's funny because it had... When the ads were out, I didn't read much on it. I just went to see it opening, you know, that Sunday it opened. And it was just like I knew barely nothing about it. I figured it was probably a retro thing. I was really stunned when I saw it. I said, "Wow, you know, they really were inspired by 1940s stuff." And they were all saying, "Oh, it was
even like 1920s stuff." Like I saw a lot of German expressionism in the style.
Yeah,
too.
1920s, 1930s, 1940s. I wouldn't say as much in the 50s. They were claiming it was inspired by Star Wars. I don't see any Star Wars inspiration in there.
I think this guy
was absorbing Republic serials. He was absorbing pulps and old time radio at the time. Sky Captain, played by Jude Law, is basically Captain Midnight of the old radio shows. But he's also G8 of the pulps, the Flying Ace. So, and there's probably some Blackhawk inspiration there as well. The comic book character, for those keeping score. He's like a combination of all these things, and gets called to the scene when the robots are attacking New York in a really breathtaking scene.
It is.
Still looks good today. I mean, you go look at it and say, okay, this is flawed CGI. Say what you want, but I mean, they kind of designed this where it looked like a perfect period piece of its time, almost as if they had CGI in the 1940s.
Well, yeah, and because I didn't see it until pretty recently.
Mm-hmm.
I missed it in the theater because I remember a lot of people going, it's not that great when I saw it. And I was, you know, in college and I was like, okay.
I knew one other person who saw it in the theater, not counting Garrow. I don't remember what Garrow thought of it. I think he was just like, Garrow gave it as usual. It's okay.
It wasn't directed by Stephen Chow, so.
Right. And it was a coworker who was older than me, but he didn't like it at all. But he couldn't explain why he didn't like it. It's like, yeah, I think some people, it's like they expect everything to be like The Mummy Returns or something. I don't know what the trope was at the time for this type of stuff or what was.
I remember one person in school I know who saw it. He said that the movie's fun. They're in New York. You're flying around, and then he goes, and then they go off to like Tibet or something, and it gets boring.
It was which was a Lost Horizon reference, by the way.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's what I believe it was. I haven't seen Lost Horizon yet. I just found I found a copy finally. I'm going to watch it, but then it's the extended version. I don't think it was released back then, but it's one of those old movies that's probably started the whole go to Tibet to seek wisdom and health.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and oh, they're all brilliant in Tibet. It, I think, created a lot of those myths.
Yeah.
And it was based on a best-selling novel by James Hilton that was huge in the 1930s. But most people say the movie is actually superior to the book. And I read the book recently, and it really doesn't hold up very well. But I am looking forward to checking out.
A lot of those old, those really influential old, genre novels.
Yeah.
Like, they're kind of stiff reads.
Boy, try reading Fu Manchu by Satcher.
Oh, I'm sure, Fu Manchu, Fantomas, Dr. Mabuza, all that stuff is kind of, it's kind of rough to read these days.
They don't move, because I've tried all of them, and the modern reader, here's the funny thing, Edgar Rice Burroughs, which was his Tarzan novels and John Carter novels, Pellucidar, all that stuff, was written around the same time, is way more readable.
It actually is. No, I've read those, and they're exciting.
He knows how to pace and create action, and has a very energetic imagination that holds up 100 years later. And these other guys just don't really have that. And they were all jealous of Burroughs. They all hated him.
Yeah. No. Yeah.
Because Tarzan outsold Mowgli, so Rudyard Kipling hated Burroughs.
Who would you rather read, Tarzan or fucking Jungle Book?
Exactly, because basically he had turned it into something that boys and men could enjoy, and women were even enjoying at the time, like this kind of romantic fantasy action that the other writers just hadn't come up with. And
even though they're nothing like the book, the Johnny Weissmuller movies. You got Johnny Weissmuller wearing nothing but a loincloth. You've got Mia Farrow's mom with her tits hanging out. You're just
she was gorgeous too.
Oh. I remember watching that, and I was like, holy shit.
The Tarzan and his mate, I think you're referring to the one of the pre-code Tarzan movies.
There's this great cleavage shot, and I sound like a fucking pig right now. I sound like a radio, I'm talking about a slasher movie or something. But right. I remember in the first Tarzan movie, Tarzan the Ape Man, there's this shot where she's in a tent washing herself, and you're just sitting there. It's this extended shot where it's clearly there just to show her cleavage for a long time.
Yeah.
But there's in Tarzan and his mate, you get the underwater swimming scene, which she was doubled by an Olympic swimmer that Weissmuller swam with. And that's full nude.
But she's also wearing this outfit that no actress today would wear.
Yeah.
And frankly, because no actress today has the body to wear that type of outfit. Because actresses today look like, thin men or something.
Oh, yeah. They all go for the super, super skinny look.
Well, they're all taking steroids when they work out because it burns fat. And they can look what they think is proper on screen. So they have, but they have no hips because they're all doing kettlebell swings, which, can take inches off your waist. But it's screwing up their physiques, and they're turning in these sort of andro women. It doesn't make much sense.
I know. I always get shocked when I look at red carpets in Hollywood, and I'm always amazed at how unattractive the women are. They all look weird. They don't look like people.
They look like ghastly heroin junkies that work out too much.
They look like ghastly heroin junkies from 70s New York glam.
Like Andy Warhol's factory.
Yeah.
It's they're going to be doing movies with Joe D'Alessandro, junkies.
Yes, exactly. I apologize to the listeners for Jackie barking in the background. I don't know what she's barking.
Well, it's kind of like Angelina Jolie is in Sky Captain.
Yes.
And
playing a very fun role, by the way.
She's having a blast, too.
And she was always playing these sort of action heroine roles like Tomb Raider and all that at this time. She kind of plays a... She basically plays the captain of the Avengers ship.
Yeah.
I was like, this is the ship from...
She's a female Nick Fury.
She is Nick Fury!
She has a total Starenko... it's a total Starenko influence character.
Starenko
did this calendar years ago, and apparently sold very well, where he did female superheroes, and it was basically shapely pinup art of women as Captain America and Batman and stuff, except it was Superwoman and Batwoman and whatever, because Starenko has a thing, hey, I like girls, right?
Yeah.
But hey, pal, don't you like women? Aren't women sexy? You know, he had that attitude with kids. And it's like, that's what she looks like. She looks like the Steranko female Nick Fury that he never drew.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I didn't make the Avenger ship. I can't believe I didn't think of Nick Fury till you brought him up.
I know. Anytime you see an eye patch, it's Nick Fury.
I know. She's like the sort of the person Sky Captain can call when he's in a pinch. Hey, Frankie.
Yeah.
He's like, we got to get Frankie, and then Frankie shows up, and it's Angelina Jolie.
Yes.
That was a fun role. And, you know, Sky Captain has his little sidekick, Dex, played by Giovanni Ribisi, mm-hmm. who can basically do anything. He's like the mechanic who can whip up anything.
He's basically like Long Tom in the Doc Savage novels.
Yes.
Who is like the mechanical genius. So he's sort of like some of Doc Savage's fabulous, you know, the Fabulous Five or whatever, condensed in one human. You know, it's like, it's all the nods were obvious. Like, when I was in the theater, I was like, wow, this is totally made for somebody like me. And then I realized by the time the credits rolled, oh man, is this going to bomb?
Yeah.
And it did. It tanked badly.
And speaking of bombs, you know, another movie we loved that bombed is John Carter.
Right.
And the Conrans were, after this movie, their next project was John Carter of Mars.
Right, because Paramount still had the option, and Sherry Lansing believed in them, and she greenlit Sky Captain. She still believed him and put them on John Carter. And then John Carter left Paramount. I don't know
what happened. There's a great article in the Telegraph called How It's a pretty recent article. It's a year old, fairly recent considering this movie's, you know, like 12 years old. It's called How Kerry Conran Saw Hollywood's Future Then Got Left Behind, and it's by Ollie Richards.
Mm-hmm.
And it said that Sherry Lant that the basically the project got killed when Sherry Lansing left as head of Paramount.
That always does that. I always wonder why filmmakers don't sign some sort of protection clause in case the regime change happens at the studio.
And if you go on YouTube, you can see the John Carter presentation reel that they put together.
Yeah.
And, you know, it looks pretty cool. I mean, I'm very happy with the John Carter movie we ended up getting, though.
Yeah.
You know, the one we got was great. But, you know, the Conrans, they're still working in Hollywood. But, mm-hmm. you know, they – Kerry Conran's not like – I mean, he says he's got some projects in the works, but he's, you know – this movie, the fallout from it, and he said he and his brother are just horrible hustlers.
Yeah, they're bad networkers. Yeah, well, it's like, okay, what happened with John Carter was Paramount wasn't done with John Carter when they were kicked off the project. What the room they it was given to Jon Favreau after that, and he didn't get anywhere with it.
Yeah,
and but what had at one point it was under Rodriguez's hands.
Yeah, I remember that. Thank God that didn't happen.
And I was like, well, that'll never get made. But supposedly the rumor at the time is the Conrads were lured away by Sony for Doc Savage.
Really?
Yes, because Doc Savage has been kicking around as a property at Sony for a long time. And they were, you know, I think they just probably renewed their option on it and probably just asked filmmakers if they want the thing. But I think they told those guys, you want to try Doc Savage. And of course, Conrans went for it and it didn't happen. You know, now Doc Savage is in the hands of Shane Black, which I think is the best case scenario, no matter what.
Yeah.
And I know some people are pissed off about The Rock being, you know, Dwayne Johnson being Doc Savage.
That's great.
And I said, you know what, if you read the old novels, it's never specific about him being white. And you would, from his description,
he's the man of bronze.
And from his description and from what is described about his father, you could totally believe that Doc is half Samoan or half Islander.
Yeah, just like has some sort of caramel.
Like he's half Caucasian, half that South American Indian tribe that Doc Savage has his gold that finances his operation. You know, it's like we never heard about Doc's mom, at least in none of the books I've read. So she could have been one of those tribeswomen, you know. And it's like, so I can totally buy into The Rock playing Doc Savage because The Rock is a little bit of everything, you know. He's like, but he's got the charisma and the build to, even though Doc Savage in the old novels is not described as a big muscle guy, like the James Bama art on the Bantam books, those have changed the visual impression of Doc Savage.
Well, and like the James Bama art, like that's what the Rock kind of looks like.
Exactly. Know? He is that brought to life.
I mean, yeah, like that's what Black's obviously going for. He's not going for the sort of blonde Boy Scout in some of the earlier art.
Right, because basically your ideal Doc Savage is Aaron Eckhart about 10 years ago.
Oh, absolutely.
Or Buster Crabbe in his prime in the 30s, you know. It's like, it's that type of look. That's basically what he is in the old stories. But everybody's impression of Doc is the James Bama art, which has also inspired all the comic book incarnations. So like it or not, that's what Doc Savage is to the few people that remember him. So, and I think The Rock is a way to guarantee it'll make money.
You know, when would have been a great Doc Savage movie would have been produced during the time when they were making stuff like The Shadow and The Phantom.
Like, yeah, that's when Frank Darabont was working on it with Chuck Russell, and they were going to have Schwarzenegger play Doc Savage.
Hey, I'm Doc Savage.
Did we dodge a goddamn bullet there.
Yeah, I'm Doc Savage.
Damn it.
Damn it. Rennie, damn it, I need to go to my Fortress of Solitude.
Ham, get your pig. Damn it. John Sunlight, stop it. I'm going to get surgery and remove his criminal element out of his brain. No, that would have been awful.
Yeah, that would have been terrible.
And it's like the 50-year-old Schwarzenegger. It's not the young Schwarzenegger. It's like, good Lord. He's in this country as long as he is, and he can't dump the accent. Good night.
I think he might be playing it up even, you know?
I think he does. I think he probably speaks better one-on-one. I think in the movies he became his own cliche.
Yeah, I need to ask some people about that.
But Shane Black, I think, is you know, it's a guarantee to make money. I mean, Sky Captain, Jude Law wasn't as big a name as he is now.
No, he was kind of on the up and up. He was in movies like AI, Alfie. That was kind of around that time when he was sort of making a name for himself. Mm-hmm. You know, like, wasn't he in some gangster movie? I can't remember. But
he was in Road to Perdition.
Road to Perdition. That's the one.
He was
he was kind of like in a lot of stuff at the time, and this was kind of he'd kicked around in some indie stuff like Existenz and some stuff Gattaca, but he had done like Enemy at the Gates too.
Russian sniper movie,
and Cold Mountain, and I remember him being Errol Flynn in The Aviator. Like, he had a little role
there. And he's a huge comic book nut. Like, he has a Rorschach tattoo on his leg.
Oh, really?
He wanted to play Rorschach in the movie, and they didn't. They went with, what's his name, from the Bad News Bears. But
he was one of the only things I liked about Road to Perdition. I thought his little psycho.
Yeah, he was good in that. That movie was pretentious and overshot.
Sam Mendes, like, as good as, Skyfall was.
Yeah,
I hate most of his movies.
Yeah, I can't stand his films. He's a terrible director.
Inspector showed that shouldn't have been allowed to make another one.
Right, I think there's merit to getting a different director for every film.
Yeah, I mean,
how would that have done with Martin Campbell at the helm? I wonder. It's just like,
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, here's the thing: if Sam Mendes hadn't been allowed, we would have been like, what would have been like if Sam Mendes had been allowed to come back?
I know. They should have gotten Chewy Hart and given him like a bucket of cocaine.
Yeah. Right?
I think it would have made a way better Bond movie.
Yeah, stay away from the CGI Chewy, you know.
Right. But like Gwyneth Paltrow is in this, and she, watching it, is my third time watching it over the years. I finally bought it on DVD like last year.
Yeah.
And
I got half-price books at like a clearance sale.
I should have held out for the Blu-ray, but I didn't for whatever reason.
Is it on Blu-ray?
I believe it is. Okay. I don't know if it looks much better. I don't know.
Because the DVD, I have the original Paramount like widescreen, and it looks pretty good.
It looks about what it looked like in the theaters, because it had that faded color look, which is a way to kind of create... it's very accurate in recreating the way Technicolor looked in the
40s. And I was thinking, this movie really does look like an older movie. The effects shockingly hold up. You can't say the same about other all CG movies at the time, like Sin City or I'm sure Cash Earn and those other ones don't hold up.
A lot of that stuff looks really bad.
Like, you know, I think 300 kind of holds up because it kind of had the muted color palette.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I watched that again, and I was like, yeah, that one looks pretty good. Like, some of the Zack Snyder's stuff always kind of paid a lot of attention to detail.
Right.
This one, like, the effects, though, like, they kept it so simple.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they didn't try to go too crazy with it, and that's what's kind of given it its longevity. And they did give it that sort of, like, old Technicolor look that kind of mixed with, like, German expressionist grandiosity.
Right. Well, because all those German guys were over in America making movies because they left, like, you know, Fritz Lang, they left Nazi Germany.
Yeah.
So a lot of 1940s Hollywood films had that look.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, if you anything with James Wong Howe, cinematography looks like that.
Yeah.
You know, when they do city shots and stuff. And that's what I loved about it. Like, people forget. And I realize this because I've been, you know, I love Republic serials and mm-hmm. I go back and watch them when I can. It's so funny watching almost any Republic production, including their movies with John Wayne, like, which I think were considered A-movies at the time. If they're showing trains, it was better for them to have the Lidecker's build a fake train and run it around a fake little mountain set than to actually go out and film a train.
Really?
Yes, you'll notice that a lot. It's in some of the Hitchcock films, too, like the stuff he did in England.
Oh, yeah, like Lady Vanishes.
If they're showing airports and cities and train stations, it's a fake city because... Mm-hmm. They couldn't just put a movie camera in a helicopter back then.
No.
Like, it was tough to get those kind of shots. So you just had the special effects department build your city or build your village or whatever for the shots.
Lady Vanishes has some of those, like, those snowbound cities and trains, and they're clearly models, you know.
It's all models because it was too troublesome back then with that technology to go get a shot of the city. It was just that difficult.
It's a lot of work. You know, and it's a lot of red tape, too.
Exactly, and it's not like today with digital cameras and stuff. And back then, they tried to make these movies as inbound in the studio as possible. And that's kind of what Skycaptor is a tribute to, is the way that Hollywood used to make movies that really immersed you into that world.
Yes.
And, like, when you watch something like The Rocketeer, it's not, you know, it's not that, oh, it's a faithful adaptation of the Dave Stevens comic, which it is for the most part, other than removing the sexuality of the Betty character. Because if you have the old graphic novels, boy, she was Betty Page, basically.
No.
And I do highly recommend those. If you can find the old Dave Stevens Rocketeer, it's fantastic, which also is loaded with Doc Savage references.
The movie was one of my favorites when I was a kid. That was like my Raiders of the Lost Ark. Like, you know.
And it's a fun movie. I watched it with my son a couple of years back, and I was surprised how it had aged well. Like, when I saw it in the early 90s, I just thought it was okay because I watched a pan and scan videotape, and I didn't see it in the theater back then, and I regretted that. And but I realized what I like about it is it has a world of, like, the late 30s, early 40s that you actually want to – it's like, I want to live in that America.
Yeah. Yeah.
Look at those buildings. Look at the way everything is and the technology.
And like this movie and that movie, you get giant Hindenburg blimps.
Right. Yes. Because they thought that was going to be the new way to travel.
Yeah, the Zeppelin. And then, oh, the humanity.
Yeah, the Zeppelin. It's a bring your family. You know, it's just like, and that one damn crash, and that was it.
Yep.
But there's been a lot of science fiction novels. Like, Michael Moorcock wrote one where the main mode of transportation became Zeppelins. You know, and in like a post-apocalyptic world or a crazed future. I think that's a lot of the steampunk stuff they talk about.
I mean, and this movie kind of has a bit of that feel, a little bit.
Right, right. But it has that kind of ideal 1940s world that never really existed except on the pages of pulp magazines or science fiction magazines. It's got that Hugo Gernsback type of look to the technology.
And the villain in it, the character that Dr. Totenkopf, who's basically CGI Laurence Olivier.
Right.
His thing, the world of tomorrow, is like his new world he's created that's like of robots and
right and what everybody thought was gonna happen.
It kind of felt weird, like the last act of the movie. This is gonna be, you know, this is a little out of your wheelhouse, John, but I think the movie the game BioShock was very influenced by some of that, because that's a game where you have this visionary of the future, although he's mostly based on Ayn Rand His name's Andrew Ryan. And his city is kind of the place where John Galt takes people from Atlas Shrugged. But the sort of like, we're going to this brave new world. It felt, I was kind of like thinking, and the feel of that game, I was like, oh, I'll bet they're fans of Sky Captain, the people who made that
game. Oh, I'm sure it was a huge influence on video game developers.
Yeah, like, because, you know, you see a lot of this game pop up in, I mean, a lot of this movie pop up in games like that. And I'm sure Bioshock Infinite 2 looks even more Sky Captain-y, because it's up in the air and all that. But
yeah, it just it's with that third act and everything, and just the way they it look. Some shots, like they were kind of in a jungle setting at one point. It looked like King Kong.
Oh, definitely, then, it was making me think of the Phantom too, with the ghost who walks.
Right. It's just like, I mean, it's just loaded with that stuff. I could probably sit there and watch it again and just look for references and be able to just pull stuff out left and right. And, you know, it's actually watching it. I started watching a Republic serial because I have a shelf of them I haven't watched yet. I would grab them when VCI, this company out of Oklahoma that's put out probably the most consistent DVD releases of those old serials. They put out like the Phantom serial and the Dick Tracy serials and stuff. They would have these sales or be like 60% off. You know, use this code for 3 days only. So I would just grab every cereal possible. But
yeah, and you've seen a lot more of those than I have. I haven't seen
a ton
of them.
When I was a kid, in 1976, and it might have been for the bicentennial, PBS, which back then was actually a real alternative to network television, in the afternoons, after Batman and Superman, and by Batman I mean the Adam West show, and then by Superman I mean, of course, George Reeves, when those ended, if you switched over to PBS, there was a Captain America. There was a chapter of a Captain America Republic serial that they ran every day, and that was my first serial that I ever saw, and I thought it was great. I didn't realize it was totally unfaithful to the comic books. He didn't even have a shield. Republic just basically paid for the costume image, and that was it. That was the only, but yet it's more faithful to the Simon Kirby stuff than those silly, timid Marvel movies that have come out lately.
Yeah.
You know, that everybody loves, but that serial was more faithful to the spirit of the comics.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, wow. And I was just like, this serial format, this is what people liked in the 1940s. And
oh yeah. You get a couple of them before a movie, you know come back next
and
week.
And I'd read about serials in like Famous Monsters. And, you know, at the time, because I was really into, okay, when Star Wars came out, a lot of kids were into Star Wars, I guess. I didn't socialize.
I
didn't socialize with enough kids to know if other kids were really into it. I knew that my older cousins were really into it because they
John
were building
was locked in his house. He didn't know.
Practically Star Wars model kits or whatever. But I didn't find other kids who talked about Star Wars my age, and many of them may have not seen it or
they were too busy talking about Super Inframan, right?
No. Actually, it's funny. There were a couple of kids who saw Super Inframan way before I did.
Oh wow.
Telling me about it, and I was really wanting to see it because I had described Ultraman because I was the only kid getting up on Saturday mornings to watch Ultraman, and nobody else was doing that. My mom would buy me these science fiction books. I was fascinated by old science fiction movies. I'd always watched them anyway because Godzilla, all the different AIP movies that would play on local television on UHF channels. So I'd have these science fiction books that I couldn't really read them, but I could look at the pictures. And they would always have all these stills from old Republic serials that look cool as hell. You know, Rocket Man, King of the Rocket Man, looks way cooler in a still photo than he actually looks in the serial. So I was really intrigued.
Who's that rocket guy, Commander Cody or something?
There's Commando Cody, and they basically use the footage from King of the Rocket Man for Commando Cody and Radar Men from the Moon, and I think they also used it again for Zombies of the Stratosphere. Because Republic, by the 1950s, they were making, their serials were really intended to be TV shows by the 1950s. But they did, there was still a little bit of a market for the serials in the theaters, so they would send them to theaters and then put them on TV like a year later. Like they were still, but they recycled footage constantly. They always recycle effect shots that the Lydeckers did, and Lydecker effects were fantastic. But when you saw these photos in these books, like, you know, it'd be the great science fiction films, and you would read about the 40s and see all these incredible stills from these serials, and it'd be like, wow, there was like this explosive imaginative cinema world in the 1940s. Because you got to think about it, after Star Wars there wasn't a ton of science fiction films in the theaters. It was still Space, Saturday Night Fever, Animal House. That was the big follow-up. Your James Bond movies were like the most fantastic thing. Most science fiction, monster movies, whatever, were still cheap, regional low budget films. They weren't like major studios didn't really jump in on it. Alien, when it came out, was R-rated. I was too young to see it.
Yeah.
You know, it was just, it wasn't this big explosion of imaginative cinema that you think it was. It's like Star Wars didn't inspire that. I think
other studios
were probably intimidated by Star Wars, going, we don't know how to duplicate this.
No, it just, it kind of, I think Spielberg had more influence on the blockbuster than Lucas did, probably.
He did. I mean, when I saw Raiders of the Lost Ark, it blew my mind.
Yeah.
But it also, it was like, I had already seen James Bond movies, which were like the big science fiction things of the time, believe
it
or not.
They had the big stunts and everything.
Right, right. And then Raiders of the Lost Ark was like, yes, this is what I want to see more of. And I knew it was inspired by Republic Serials. And then around that same time, and it might have been because of Raiders of the Lost Ark, PBS started running this show called Matinee at the Bijou. Matinee at the Bijou was designed to duplicate the experience. They showed it on Saturday mornings, like right before lunch. It was about 2 hours, I think. And it would have the cartoon, it would have the newsreel, it would have a chapter of a serial, and then it would have a feature film that ran like 65 minutes. Like it would be like a Laurel and Hardy movie, something you would see in the 40s. And then I saw Zorro's Fighting Legion. A lot of the stunts and Raiders are in Zorro's Fighting Legion. They were done there. Like yeah. The going under the Jeep and that sort of thing. Except he goes up under a wagon in Zorro's Fighting Legion. It's Yakima Kanut. And it looks like he gets trampled by horses and probably did.
Yeah, I used to watch all that Zorro stuff when I was a kid. I don't really remember much of it because I haven't seen it in forever. I remember seeing the first like Martin Campbell Zorro movie,
right?
But you know, I remember watching Zorro all the time as a kid, but I don't remember which incarnation it was because it was on TV a lot.
Probably the Guy Williams Zorro. When I was a kid, the Alain Delon Zorro movie played on CBS once a month. It was
really?
So popular. It played constantly. It actually caused a Zorro revival because it was so popular on television. It was a really well-done movie. It was directed by Duccio Tessari, who did all those really fun spaghetti westerns. And it's a really spirited, action-packed French-Italian co-production. And Delon's like the perfect Zorro. It's still like my favorite Zorro movie. And I've seen all of them, but that's like my favorite.
Yeah, I think looking at it on here, I think it was Guy Williams that I saw.
It's probably Guy Williams because Disney put him back in syndication.
That's when I saw it. It was on Disney Channel.
Right. So, like, and then when the Republic serials were on videotape, I would rent them and stuff and enjoy them. And then I didn't watch them for years. And then I think I picked up Zorro's Fighting Legion in a bargain bin because Troma had released it with the Rowan Group for some reason.
What?
And I watched it and just thought it was the greatest thing. I showed it to my kid. He was 2 years old. And he was looking forward to it every chapter and finding out who Dom Del Oro was. Because the old Republic serial was always a masked villain. And you didn't know who it was. And then the writers probably didn't even know who it was until they filmed the last chapter. You know, it was just like, oh, okay, it turns out to be this guy who was, you know, third guy from the left in this one scene. But that was always the fun of it. And I watched that and I was like, man, I really like these serials. Like, I miss watching them. Type of stuff. Sky Captain kind of reminded me how much I missed watching that stuff as well. It's like there's so many great ideas, so much good action, and they took it seriously. It wasn't campy.
It didn't make fun of it. Like
right,
it wasn't
right.
Trying to show you that it's smarter or better than what it's paying homage to. It was very serious.
Yeah, a lot of stuff now that's made as a tribute has a superiority complex to what came before.
It's kind of got to kind of take the piss a bit.
Yeah,
and it's
like
it's not
you know,
doing
you
that.
Like this. If you actually like this stuff, you're stupid. You know, it's
because the movie kind of felt like it had a bit of the tone of like the '90s superhero stuff.
Yeah,
it definitely felt like it kind of came from that school, like the Shadow, the Phantom, you know, that kind of stuff that came in the wake of Tim Burton's Batman.
But it improved on it in one thing.
What's that?
He's not a troubled hero.
Yeah, no, he's not.
To redeem himself, which is the worst thing about the post-Tim Burton stuff, is every hero, even they did it to the Shadow, he's redeeming his past.
Oh, yes, he's got
no, he, it. No, they can't get it in their head. Screenwriters have this problem. And this is what, and, you know, thank God for the Conrans, you know, who threw this all out. And this, by the way, this is also, I think, the problem with the Lone Wolf, not Lone Wolf, the Lone Ranger movie from a few years ago that
oh,
I never finished.
It.
I got an hour into it, I was done. I was like, it had me tap out easily. But it's just this idea that the hero on screen cannot be a better human being than anybody in the audience. And yeah. John Burney talks about this on his crazy forum, where he whines about guns and stuff. But he does have some gems that he talks about, especially some Alan Moore. And when he talks about the way they're afraid to portray heroes in movies today, and it's like screenwriters think there's no way that this hero can be a better human being than the person writing the screenplay or anybody in the audience.
Yeah, no, it's true. They have to knock him down a peg. And
right.
The only thing in this movie is the sort of rocky past that Sky Captain has with the Polly Perkins character, Gwyneth Paltrow's character.
And that's basically the Howard Hawks dysfunctional previous relationship. That's all that is.
Yeah, that's all. Like, it's like, you know, it's like Bogey and Bacall.
Right. She's even trying to talk like a Hawksian girl, you know, like from the old Howard Hawks movies. I don't think she does a very good job. In fact, I think the weak point I noticed watching this the third time, Gwyneth Paltrow is awful in this movie.
Yeah,
she just doesn't seem to be on the same page. I don't know if it's her limited acting skills because she's basically a product of nepotism, or it could also be the fact, you know, I look at Jude, you know, was it the green screen scenario? Was this too new of a way of making movies that the actors were thrown off? Well, I don't know. Jude Law is fine in this film. He's terrific. Everybody else is doing just fine. Yeah. It's her. You know, she just doesn't have, she's too limited in her skills to really fall into this. You know, maybe it would have been better with Angelina Jolie in the role or some other cute actress at the time. You know, I don't.
Angelina Jolie has kind of a danger factor to her, though. You know?
She does. She looks like a bad girl, you know.
Yeah.
She's a perfect example of, if you see her in that Gia movie.
Oh, yes.
Where she's playing, good Lord. I mean, she'd make Michael Jackson quit the Boy Scouts.
Yes.
She was so friggin' hot.
Oh, and I remember being in like high school and one of my friends going, dude, you have to see this.
Yeah. Oh man, she was super hot. And then a couple of years later, she signs on to do the Lara Croft Tomb Raider thing. She starts working out too much and loses.
She got weird looking.
Yeah, she loses the curves and loses the shape and the softness. And
was it? I remember she looked. I thought she looked gross in Wanted. Did you see Wanted?
Oh God, she looks like she's shrinking.
She looked like she had full blown like anorexia.
She reminded me of Jock Mahoney in Tarzan's Three Challenges. Because have you ever heard this story?
No.
I should tell this story because it's pretty awesome and sad. Tarzan's Three Challenges was Jock Mahoney, his last Tarzan movie. And at the time, Jock Mahoney was like, I think, 42 years old, 41 years old, whatever. You know, look it up on IMDb and correct me if you want. I don't care. But he was old, but he was in fantastic condition. And he was king of the stuntmen. He could do anything. And Woody Strode, who was his co-star, if you don't know who Woody Strode is.
Oh, Woody Strode's the best.
Quit listening to this podcast right now and go watch some movies. Woody Strode said, yeah, we were in Thailand with Jock Mahoney. He's playing Tarzan. And he at that time, I swear to you, Jock Mahoney was the strongest man on earth. And he said, the problem was he was really thought he was Tarzan. And thought he was invincible, and we were filming next to the dirtiest river in Thailand, and I begged him, don't dive in that river, it's filthy, it'll kill you. Jock Mahoney dives in it, he suffers from dysentery, and several other a lot of infections. He's basically breathing in an oxygen tent in between takes. He loses 40 pounds while they're making Tarzan's Three Challenges. When you watch the film, by the end of the film, he is, you know, earlier in the film, he looks like a pulp character brought to life. He looks like the strongest man on earth. He looks like Tarzan would look when he's 41 years old.
He started to look like shit, right?
I mean, right. Then, as the film, you see him lose weight. They obviously filmed the thing in sequence because it looks like he's losing weight. By the end of the film, scrawny arms and his stomach is sticking out and his ribs are sticking out. And I mean, you can order the film off Warner Archives. It sometimes plays on TCM. It's a good movie. It's a good action film. And Woody Strode is just badass. Jock Mahoney looks like he's dying before your eyes. It's like, it's frightening. And after that, he looked haggard and old. And Woody Strode said he was never the same after that. And, you know, I think he died like maybe 2 decades later. You can look it up. But he didn't die right after the film, but he looked like he aged 20 years after he did that film.
Well, I've heard about like actors who would like fall in for a movie. They would fall in the water in Venice or something, and then they'd have health problems afterward.
Yeah, Georgia Maharis claims that he got hepatitis C from doing a scene in like a lake or a pond or a river in Route 66. Mm. And he got super ill and decided it. Also, he was getting movie offers, so he quit the show. Of course, now they're also saying it was because he was a closet homosexual, and the producer was pissed off. That doesn't really jibe because a lot of those leading guys on 60s TV were gay.
Oh yeah,
so,
a lot of them.
Yeah, I couldn't see that being a factor, but maybe he felt like, okay, I got hepatitis C. Screw this! I'm getting out of this. You know, a double should have done that scene.
I'd heard that like Audrey Hepburn's health problems were related to something like that.
Oh, because she did Mogambo.
Yeah.
Yeah, or did she do? Or I'm thinking of Ava Gardner.
Or no, she did. She did some movie where she fell in like nasty water. It might have been Venice or something.
Oh yeah, she might have been the one who fell in. I mean, it happens. I'm sure there's probably an interesting film facts article in that idea of actors who got really terribly ill after doing films.
But yeah, that makes sense though. That water would have fucked him over,
right? But Angelina Jolie in Wanted reminded me of like,
yeah,
Jack
she looks sick in the movie. Like I remember that when she popped up in the movie, I was like, she doesn't look hot, she looks gross. Like
I know, and she, you know, I saw her in the movie Salt, which I thought was okay, and there's some shots she just looks like, you remember why she got so much acclaim, she's so gorgeous looking in some shots, and but in other shots she just looks like she's working out too much.
Yeah,
and she's losing the feminine quality. She's trying to look like a, you know, she's trying to be built like Bruce Lee or something. I don't get it. I can't imagine wanting to look like that.
Bruce Lee, there's another guy who looked gross in his last movie.
Enter the Dragon, he looks like he's about to fall over.
Yeah.
You know, we've gotten down that road before.
Covered that, though. Yeah.
Right. Not healthy looking. And it's just like, it's unfortunate. But, boy, you look at her in Gia, holy
yeah,
mackerel.
She's stunning. Stunning.
I know. And it's like, the Hollywood industry basically ruined another beauty, basically. You know, now I think she's probably going to be done with films in a few years. But she's terrific in this, though. She has the total bad girl vibe presence and basically playing the female Nick Fury.
Yep. And another movie this sort of reminded me of was, did you ever see that? I know you're not a fan of anime, really, but Castle in the Sky, the Miyazaki movie?
I've seen it, I think. Yeah.
It kind of has a similar plot with like a madman with like a world apart he's trying to build.
Oh, very likely.
And it has the kid who flies the plane around. There's the sky pirates and stuff. So it's from 86. It was also kind of similar, kind of thought of that when I saw it.
Yeah, there's definitely probably some inspiration there. And Miyazaki could have been inspired by the same sources.
Oh, yeah, totally.
If you watch, there's one of the Lupin the Third cartoons that he did in the last season, and it got an English dub release over here, the one episode, where it had these robots attacking the city, and they look just like the robots in the Superman, the Fleischer Brothers Superman cartoon short.
Yeah, like it reminded me of the robots in like the Fleischer Brothers. It reminded me a little bit
the Sky Captain does the same thing. They do the robots from basically the Fleischer Brothers Superman shorts, which, by the way, you can watch on YouTube, and I think are the best version of Superman anywhere.
And it's sort it's great. And it some of it also reminded me a little bit of like some of the Osamu Tezuka stuff, which was very influenced by the same sources, the American stuff.
Because they would see American stuff and say,
that Astro Boy and all that, you know, it's very influenced by American pop culture.
Right. And so it's almost like, and there's a nod to Godzilla in the film. That's very funny.
Yes.
so, I mean, the movie to me, the heart was in the right place. It was obviously made with a real love of film, not a cynical reference to films they like when they were kids, like Quentin Tarantino's stuff.
Well, and it's so funny because these guys, you read the story about this movie being made, and it seems like they had the whole, like, they had the world in their pocket, and they had all these filmmakers who were like, oh, you guys are geniuses.
Yeah.
And it just, they didn't really get the juice out of it that they could have.
Right. They couldn't play the game. They couldn't hustle. And that's part of the factor in Hollywood.
And that's the story of a lot of filmmakers. There's a lot of brilliant filmmakers, but they don't have that salesman quality.
I have often felt that filmmakers, instead of going to film school, they should also go to business school.
Oh, totally. Like, I mean, it doesn't matter. You can be as talentless as Brett Ratner, but he's a good talker. You know,
and he's got a good agent.
He does. He's got a great age. I mean, you know, they're part of the chosen, John. But
yes, He's part of the. I mean, he's part of the Velvet Mafia. Come on,
yeah, come on, come on.
I got a blowjob from.
Oh,
a
I got a blow. I didn't realize. I didn't realize it was a man.
I didn't know. Yeah, whatever. Yeah, jeez. Don't know what an Adam's apple looks like.
I think it was
Jesus.
Very homophobic when Brett Ratner was crucified for saying rehearsals for fags. Come on, they can call each other. They can call each other that. Come on.
I love it that Eddie Murphy dropped out. They're both transvestite chasers.
Oh,
let's be honest. But,
yes, they are.
You know, but I thought I actually respected Eddie Murphy, even though I hate Brett Ratner. But I totally respected Eddie Murphy for dropping out.
Yeah,
and he would have been my only reason to watch the Oscars.
Oh, totally. If he was hosting, I would have watched.
But then again, I also realized it's not the 1984 Eddie Murphy anymore. It's the 2000.
It's the 1,000 words Eddie Murphy.
Yeah, 2012 Eddie Murphy. That's not quite as funny.
You're not going to get up there. He's not going to talk about kids screaming into Mr. T's ass or something.
somebody had said, I think it might have been Joe Rogan, but he was thinking that you know, Eddie Murphy doesn't want to do stand up anymore because he can't handle the heckling from the transvestite fetish stuff. Which is possible.
Possible.
Like, he's claiming, oh...
I think he doesn't need to do it, you know?
No, I think he's got so much money he doesn't care.
Like, I mean, like, stand-up is one of those things that once you can, you walk away from it. Like, people only ever go back to it when they have to.
Unless you're crazy like Dave Chappelle, and then you have to go back to
it.
Yeah,
Dave Chappelle is fucking nuts.
He is a nutcase.
Like, everybody, even people who worked on his show said he was nuts. You know?
Yeah, he went crazy. Neil Brennan, the co-creator of his show, his brother, was on Kumia.
Which was fucking great. Did you see?
Yeah, and he was just like, no, Dave Chappelle went crazy.
He's like, oh, he went crazy. And he ran off, and my brother started having to do stand-up. And he's not very good stand-up, and I said that, and now he won't talk to me. But whatever, I don't care. He's the youngest. Fuck him.
But yeah, there's this sort of the poor Conroys. If they were just, you know, it's unfortunate that they couldn't extend from this. They should have made 6 or 7 movies by now.
I mean, and they're still working. I mean, it's not like they've left the industry.
Yeah. Well, no, they did say something interesting. They said they originally intended to make this for $5 million with no actors.
Well,
when they went
to John Avnet, the producer,
they
said they could make it for like 3 or 5 or something.
Yeah.
And they said he said even with the big names, he said they could have made it for 30. And
right.
He said the budget went to 75. And he says they have no fucking idea. He goes, I don't know where that number comes from.
Yeah, they don't stand by the budget quote.
Yeah, which is a common story in Hollywood. You always hear that because Hollywood accounting, I think, is very shady. It's always seems like it's out to screw people. Mm-hmm. But they said the budget was 75, and they're like, I have no idea how in the hell we could have possibly spent $75 million on this movie.
Well, I thought the same stuff was done in John Carter.
Oh, totally.
I mean, I do know that. I have read stuff that implied that the director, John Carter, was driving the budget up because they were doing reshoots, and which it's not uncommon for them to do it on Pixar or cartoons.
Which when people say reshoots, they always think, oh, it must suck, but it's a common practice.
Yeah, it actually is, but the way he was doing reshoots was costing the studio money, it was costing a lot of money. But I still think they completely goofed the accounting on that. I think Disney's a scummy company.
They're the biggest pushers of this social justice type mentality.
Oh, they're horrible. I actually really don't want to support them anymore. I mean, you know, it's not just the kid getting eaten by the alligator or whatever and the stupidity of how they run their parks, but it's like it's a scummy company. Like, I think the Marvel stuff has just been so lame. For something that I'm paying the ticket price, I'm paying for that stuff is shit.
Yeah, I haven't even seen Civil War yet. I mean,
Don't even bother. I'm telling you, don't even bother. It's not that good. It's just like
I want to see Batman versus Superman again before I see it.
I would see that 100 times before I watch Civil War again.
That director's cut's supposed to be good. I heard.
Yeah, that's what they say. Who knows? But doesn't that say something that Warner Brothers wasn't willing to put out the preferred cut? Like, we've gotten into this thing where you're paying to see basically a half-assed version in theaters, and then the real version is on Blu-ray.
Yeah. It just goes to show that they don't value the theatrical experience anymore.
They're discouraging seeing this stuff in theaters, and they don't even realize it. It's a real shell game they're basically pulling. But yeah. I really don't like the Disney company for this idea that, you know, we're not going to create a new franchise. We're buying Star Wars anyway.
Yeah, we're just going to buy up other properties. You know?
We're going to buy Marvel. It's just like, it's not the old Walt Disney attitude was, we're going to create something out of this public domain property and make it our own.
Yeah, like, let's get Treasure Island, you know? That was one of my favorite movies as a kid. We're going to do Treasure Island. We're going to do Snow White. We're going to do...
Have you seen the Charlton Heston Treasure Island with Christian Bale?
No.
It rocks.
Okay.
I'm going to
watch that.
I got it download, but it is available on DVD. It was done for Turner TNT, the Turner Network, back when it was did a lot of original movies that were supposed to be theatrical quality for cable television. And Ted Turner just gave Charlton Heston something like $10 million and happened to have the Mutiny on the Bounty boat. He owned it. The boat that was used in Mutiny on the Bounty.
It's got Oliver Reed. Holy shit.
Yeah, and Christopher Lee. And it was like, and literally Ted Turner told Heston and his son Fraser, who wrote and directed it, he was like, "Look, I own the ship that was used in Mutiny on the Bounty. It's docked in Florida. You guys can just use it and film it there, and I'll write the check for filming all." And it's really good. It's really, really good.
All right. Well,
it's totally straightforward. It's not watered down. Like the Disney version is good, but it's a little watered down for Disney. And it's like, this is more like the Robert Louis Stevenson book, you know, brought to life. And
that was my favorite story as a kid, Treasure Island.
A lot of fun. I didn't get to read it when I was a kid. I kind of went from like little golden books to famous monsters to comic books to H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds to Edgar Rice Burroughs and Robert E. Howard and, you know, and on and on.
Yeah,
I didn't go through that Harry Potter phase of reading that kids go through now.
Well, I didn't either, but I mean, I was all about like the old adventure, like pirate stories, you know.
Right. And Treasure Island used to be pushed on kids a
like
lot.
Like Davy Crockett. Like it was all like the sort of like Swiss Family Robinson, Kidnapped, all that stuff. Like all the old you know, stuck out at sea, like we're out in the wilderness.
I love that stuff too. I love good, solid adventure stories when I was a kid. Anything that was like, and I also loved the history of like the landmark books. I always talk about those. Like those were just the greatest things for a young kid to really fire up your interest in history. And my son wants to, he's too young to really read them, but he wants me to read him the original Rudyard Kipling Mowgli stories from the Jungle Book. So we saw the movie. Great. And the movie's a Disneyfication. I said, well, it's not really like the stories.
Yeah, it's more like the Disney cartoon.
Right. It was basically a remake of a cartoon. It was okay. I mean, it was fine. I forgot about it a day later. You know, it wasn't anything innovative. It was just like, you know, I'll read to them or whatever. But it's like, to me, that's like classic storytelling that really kids should have. It, don't try to push like Marvel superhero video games and movies on kids and without getting some classics into their heads first.
Yeah, I know. I always loved the old Davy Crockett movies that they made. And that fired up my interest in like the Alamo. And you know, it kind of gets you going down this rabbit hole, you know?
Oh, yeah. I love the Scarecrow Romney Marsh when I was a kid. And
I think I ever got into that.
It was a Disney movie with Kip Patrick McGowan when they did real high quality TV movies they filmed in England because they had this money that was tied up in England that they couldn't leave the country. So they just had to, Walt just invested it in productions there and hired the best of the British film industry to make these movies for families. And Patrick McGowan and his crew, a couple of years before they made The Prisoner, they made The Scarecrow Romney Marsh, and it's really good.
Okay.
There's some good stuff there. It was also the same story. It was based on, I don't know if it was a real historical character or not, but the same story inspired the Hammer film, Captain Clegg, with Peter Cushing and Oliver Reed.
Oh, yeah, sure, yeah.
Which is a good version of the story, but the Scarecrow Romney Marsh is probably the better version. But, yeah, I like the live-action Disney stuff of the 50s and 60s. It's a classic storytelling thing there. Pre-Star Wars, a lot of that stuff is really good.
Mm-hmm.
And good for the brain, I think. It gets kids thinking.
It kind of makes you want to go out and do stuff. Like I would always go run around at my grandmother's ranch, you know, outside.
Yeah.
And you know, like kind of make up your own adventures, you know.
Yeah, well you explore ponds, you explore forests and stuff, but we were more encouraged to do that stuff back then. Mm-hmm. There wasn't helicopter parenting and you know, a pedophile on every corner and all that stuff.
Yes.
And sex offender registries.
In fact, that's what the corner's called over there, Pedophile Corner.
Yeah, exactly. It's Pedophile Corner.
It's stay away from Pedophile Corner now.
It's across the street from Transvestite Bend.
There's a man over there in a van with milk duds melting in his lap.
But yeah, it was different back then. It's like, I think a lot of that classic storytelling is good for kids. It's what I like about old time radio. You have to use your brain.
You have to imagine stuff. You bring it out. You paint the picture. I mean, that's what's great about books. You know, like,
yeah, exactly. You're just like, you're creating the characters. You're doing the casting. You're setting the effects.
I was
budget.
Explaining it's... that to one of my classes. Like, you know, don't you imagine like what's going on when you read a book, like, you know, you read these words and it paints a picture. All the kids just kind of looked at me.
Yeah,
like,
and
no,
they kind
okay.
of they skipped that development because video games were put in their hands when they were two.
I know that. Yeah, like, you know, I play video games. I like video games, but you know, I don't think video games should be introduced at an early age. It's
no, not
terrible.
At all. We've banned them from the house. Yeah. I won't allow them in the house.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't
I don't think they have anything positive to offer kids. Like, you know, when you're a little older, sure, but you know, at that young an age, I think it does something with the dopamine in the brain that it's too exciting, you know.
It is. Well, it's a passive mental masturbation.
And it's dopamine squirting out, you know? Like,
right.
And it's just flooding your brain.
It's like,
you know, anything else, it provides a quick rush.
Exactly. And there's
that
sort
you want
of
over
a,
and over again.
Well, it's like Harlan Ellison had mentioned that his biggest inspiration was writing was old-time radio because it taught him how to think and imagine, and the type of the crisp kind of concise words to use to describe a story. That's what old-time radio did for him. And it was like he said that was his biggest inspiration was shows like The Mysterious Traveler and Lights Out for when he was writing his don't call it science fiction, speculative fiction short stories. That's his big inspiration. He says it was old-time radio that really taught him how to write that way.
Yeah, which is interesting. That makes sense, you know?
Yeah, and of course he was inspired by the old-time pulps where the storytelling is very overloaded yet fast to read.
You read any mystery novel, and it's just like you get those storytelling beats down pretty quick. Just boom,
right.
Boom, 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 and you know good cliffhanger, all that stuff.
Yeah, and you know those were created because the working class people, they wanted to read, but they didn't want to read Mark Twain and Dostoevsky and all that.
They wanted to read
Tolstoy.
Mickey Spillane.
They wanted to read something fast and entertaining that would occupy them for an hour and a half or so, and that's where you got all these Mickey Spillane novels and, you know, Doc Savage, as I've said, is actually written for kids, but probably stuff like The Spider and Weird Tales and all the various men's adventure pulps of the 40s, the Western pulps especially. It's like that was meant to entertain that working class. They wanted to read, but they didn't want to read the classics they were forced to read, and but you know, the old schools. Like Little House on the Prairie, I guess, by that time.
Yeah.
But, it's just like, it's a type of storytelling, like, all right, some of the biggest paperbacks right now are those Lee Child Jack Reacher novels.
Oh, yeah, they're huge.
And I think all he's done is really, it's just an update of the Shadow Doc Savage formula.
Oh, yeah, you read those, and like, I think we've talked about how if the Jack Reacher movie was like a... was like a had like Clint Eastwood in it, it would be the greatest thing ever, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Clint Eastwood in the 70s, you know, not
right now. If it was Eastwood in 1974, would have been like the greatest action movie ever made, you know. As it is, I liked it a lot. I think what's his name, Chris McQuarrie, is a really good director for escapist entertainment.
And I love Herzog as the villain. When I was in the gulag, I had to eat my fingers one by one to gain nourishment.
Yeah, it's like it worked. For whatever reason, it worked. It worked really well. It's actually one of the most entertaining thrillers I've seen in recent years. It's and I even got it on Blu-ray. I mean, I found it in a bin for like $3.99. It was like, okay, I'm getting this. But it's like it's a good enough film. It justifies it. But that if you read those books, I think the books are basically that. Hey, I'm a working class dude. I want something fun to read that's like an action movie. I don't want to read anything intellectual, you know.
Well, and plus, like, I mean, you talk to anybody, not, you don't even have to be working class. Like, you talk to a doctor or something.
Right, right.
They go, I don't want to watch anything. I don't want to read anything that's too heavy. I just want something that is going to entertain me because I'm fucking tired.
Yeah, I need to take a load off.
And, well, I get the same feeling, like, you know, when I've had a fucking day, I'm like, I don't want to watch something off my Criterion shelf. I'm going to watch something off the Arrow shelf.
Yeah, that's Mr. Arrow shelf. But, you know, one of the biggest proponents of the Jack Reacher novels, and also a lot of other escapist airport fiction for men, is Malcolm Gladwell.
Really?
The big intellectual, you know, writer.
Well,
of...
You know, I know some people who I consider to be, you know, not that I'm so great, but like plebs, you know, mm-hmm. who get really turned on by Malcolm Gladwell, you know.
Right, and Malcolm Gladwell endorses spy novels, and, well,
and
he loves it.
He puts things in, like, a really easy to kind of digest terms, I think, like these big ideas.
Yeah, I like reading his stuff. He's not always on point. I think you can definitely pick apart his ideas and his points. You know, there's a lot to dismantle, but I'm entertained reading his stuff, and it has me thinking. But he wrote a big thing pushing the Jack Reacher novels in The New Yorker. And why they were the most entertaining books he reads. And then he also said in an interview that when he was a kid, he loved reading Harlan Ellison. And he also loved reading William F. Buckley. He's actually apparently a closet conservative
of
some sort.
Well, if he reads William F. Buckley and has nice things to say, then yes, he probably
does. Well, he used to write for the American Spectator.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah, exactly. But he's tried to hide that part of his past because I think he thinks that people won't pay attention to him if they think he's conservative or whatever.
Oh, yeah, I mean, The New Yorker and all that stuff. Like,
so he associates with, like, Bill Simmons' group of liberal writers and everything, but but he doesn't... He actually praised William F. Buckley, like, he's willing to praise William F. Buckley in interviews and stuff, and, like, he said that was his hero when he was young.
Yeah, we might have to do that, speaking of William F. Buckley, we might have to do that Best of Enemies documentary, because I kind of want to piss on it a little bit.
Yeah, I found it rather contrived, but yeah. We might do a show on it. That'll be the sequel to our Timothy Leary Jordan.
Yeah, we might have to do it. I was kind of getting annoyed watching it.
Right. And I think sometimes that's like, I admire James Ellroy's novels a great deal. And James Ellroy, I think, knows he writes books that are very, they take some work.
I'm not going to make any jokes, John.
Right, it's like
you're a conservative,
he's,
just like me.
But he's
hey, me and you, buddy. We're the only ones in here.
We're
like
the only ones in here.
We like Israel. We're the only ones. But his books are a little too heavy, I think, for the casual reader. You know, they sell very well, but like, I remember my dad was a big fan of Le Carre and Robert B. Parker.
I always thought Le Carre was a big commie.
He turned out to be.
Yeah, he said, like, the wrong side lost the Cold War. I was like, fuck you, commie.
You know, after that, his novels must
suck
have
on Thor's hammer, commie. Yeah,
exactly. I need to copyright that saying before the alt-right grabs it. Yeah. But the Le Carre, it's like after he said that, apparently a lot of anti-Americanism popped up in his work later on. Like, it was more blatant. I think it was always there, but it was even more blatant, I think, later on, because my father-in-law...
Oh, yeah, the pillar of Panama, holy shit. Like,
my father-in-law was like, I'm getting really tired of Le Carre. He's, boy, he's got an attitude in his books. I'm just not digging. I go, well, you ought to try Charles McCarry. And I said, I think Charles McCarry is actually a better writer than Le Carre on his best day. Like, Charles McCarry at his worst is better than Le Carre. And if you read Le Carre was kind of... whereas Le Carre was like, the Soviet Union's no worse than the United States... Charles McCarry was kind of like, he was a JFK Democrat, probably a bit more conservative nowadays.
Well, yeah, JFK's policies were a little more Republican today than they
were.
Right.
And Charles McCarry wrote these books where the CIA is, you know, that's good, smart men working for them. But there also is a conspiracy to kill Kennedy. And, I mean, it's fiction, but his conspiracy is more believable than... You know, the Oliver Stone world.
Oh, yeah, which is absolute. That is the ravings of a madman. I mean,
right.
Incredibly entertaining ravings, I should add.
Yeah. Well, it's the editing and the character.
Totally. It's all that stuff. But, you know, it's fucking madness.
I wish if I had a portable podcast kit, I would ask James Ellroy what he thinks about the Oliver Stone JFK and just hear him go on probably the most hilarious rant.
Yeah.
Why he hates it. But, or for all I know, he might like it. I don't think he does, though. But Charles McCarry wrote these really good novels in the 70s, and I think he's still writing them now. He's actually put out some recent works, but they're really intelligent spy novels with maybe a smarter point of view, a more balanced moral compass than what you find in Le Carre's stuff. And I find his stuff way more interesting than, you know, these British guys who just hate everything and, you know, when they were actually doing the wet work in the field,
yeah,
you know, they were thinking about defecting to the Soviet Union. It's like, okay, whatever, you know. As some people have said, you have to have a very screwed up mind to write fiction, and I think guys like John Le Carre are proof of that.
Yeah, definitely. And I never thought, like, when I always hear this defect to the Soviet Union, it's like, yeah, life's great over there.
Yeah, I think
they've got the wall people are trying to cross to get away from. You know,
I think they're just weird neuroasthenics that spend their whole time, the rest of their lives, being afraid of people who intimidated them in high school.
No, it really is. A lot of people's prejudices and a lot of people's likes and dislikes, it's formed in high school. There's the crowd that didn't accept you, and so you hate them.
Yeah,
or you know. And there's, you know, some people who did too well in high school and they kind of bottom out later. And,
right. Oh, can you name a genius who skipped grades, graduated early, finished college early, that actually was a big success?
No.
Because I can't.
Ben Shapiro?
Ooh. Ooh. Oh, I don't know if we should be aiming at that market.
I'm sure there's somebody out there. But yeah, it's one of those things where it's like, you know, I remember when I was in college, I saw this girl walking around campus who was, like, really young.
Yeah.
Like, you know, early teens. I always felt so bad for her.
Right.
I was like, you know, you have no peer group here at all.
Yeah.
Like, not even as friends, you know, not even, like, in class. Right. Like, nobody wants to hang with you. You're just, you know, you're...
I think if you finish early, you're probably better off going to community college or city college and living with your parents.
Yeah.
I don't think you should be on a state university campus or anything at that at a young
age. No, this was like at a private, liberal arts school, you know. It's just like,
yeah.
I was like, I felt so bad for this girl. I was like, God, you don't have any, you know, who are you talking to here?
You know, you might actually be better off just working for a couple of years.
So, yeah. I think working it's not a bad deal. Like, you know, you get to know people go to school and they come out of college. I just saw this story about this girl who was fired from her internship because she proposed a more lax dress code.
Yeah.
Like, she wanted a more lax dress code at work and she proposed that. And the company fired her and everybody who signed the petition because it's like, you're a fucking intern. That's like being a guest and demanding that person, the host, be a better host. You know, and it's just like, no, that's not how it works. And by the way, the people at the company, the person at the company who was like breaking dress code, it was like a veteran who had his legs blown off. And so he was able to wear these shoes, you know. And so it was just, she was so shocked. She was like, I did everything the way I learned in school. It's like, that's not how the real world works.
Yeah.
You have to pay your dues. You have to take your licks. You have to work, you know, and become part of the company before you can pull shit like that.
Yeah, unless you're entrepreneur minded and you go start your own
business. Yeah, you go start your own company.
18. Yeah, it's like, and some can do that. Some have the brain for that.
I know. I remember there was this kid in Memphis who started, he was like this little black kid. He started this bow tie company and it's become wildly successful. Like,
good for him.
Isn't that awesome?
That's a real American.
I was like, that is a fucking American right there. He's this little kid. He looks like he's this little dressed up. He's got bow tie, and he started this bow tie company. And I remember reading about it when it happened, and I was like, oh, that's nice. But, and then I heard about it again, and it's like, he's actually become like a success with it.
I wish I'd been that smart.
Yeah, me too.
Because let me tell you, work sucks.
Yeah. I've always had a really rotten business mind. I've never been able to like get it straight, you know.
Yeah, well, it requires a lot of investment and time, and you're going to be working. Like, my sister owns her own salon and runs it, and she really doesn't. It's an upscale salon in a really fancy neighborhood, and by the way, she says she cannot find good young help.
Oh,
nobody has a work ethic. It's impossible. And she said she's as lenient as she can be, and it's impossible to find good help because just nobody has this work ethic at all. And but, you know, she only makes a few thousand dollars more than I do a year.
Yeah.
You know, really, when you
it's a
when
lot
you
of extra
away,
work for
not it, right, return. And she, you know, she's 7 days a week. She's running that place, and it's like, you know, it's you have to be willing to really stretch out for that sort of thing.
Yeah,
and you have to want to do it. But yeah, I couldn't imagine. I couldn't imagine because like I like to take vacations, I like to take days off.
Yeah,
like
yeah,
call
yeah,
it, sure. Like to call in sick for a stress day.
Well, I go like there's a concert coming up. I'm going to call in sick the next day and leave. Plans for
exactly.
A sub, you know. I'm not calling sick. I don't do that. I'm going to say, hey, I'm putting in for the day off, and here's some plans for a sub. You know,
like, right?
It's just it's like that. You know, I like to take there's concert tonight, taking the next day off. You know,
right. It's like I don't need a business named after me. I need to somebody to inherit from me or anything. But yeah, it's just like. That kind of work ethic. I think that's also why we like these 1940s.
Yeah, I was about to say, we need to swing it back to
see. Yeah, we were reviewing this film. I think there is something about this that 1940s is like Sky Captain is, and it comments on it a little bit. It's American exceptionalism.
Yeah, it is. Like,
it used to be real. It's like, hey, man, they used to build what the Empire State Building was built in like. Something like 6 months. That's some crazy short period of time.
And then other people went, oh, I got to top that.
Yeah, and nowadays.
Chrysler Building. I'm going to build a Sears Tower.
Nowadays, it would take like 15 years.
Oh, well, yeah, and that's people like bilking money out of others. That's all it is.
Well, it's like I live in Denver where they have been working on the same highway overpass for 15 years.
Oh, that's the way it is here in Dallas. These highways have been under construction. It feels like since I've been in high school. It's crazy.
It's like, you know, where's a Bud Abbott looking guy to whip that crew in shape? Come on,
yeah,
come
we
on,
need
fellas.
We need Sky Captain chicken? To come in and have it because I bet Sky Captain built that base in just a few days. You know,
yeah. You want some guy that comes in that looks like Bogart? You know, come on, you scramps. You know, let's get this going. It's like, where's that American exceptionalism? We don't see it anymore. It's like everybody's just tries to pad.
No, and any time somebody preaches that, they're bad. They're oh, it's nationalism. That's why this Brexit thing is so hated, is because it's nationalism.
Right. It's like, yeah, how scary the idea that England would be on its own, like it was,
like throughout like large
throughout history until like 20 years ago. You know,
and you know the pound is already bouncing back. So.
Right. Well, the stock market dove like it does every couple of years because it does that. You
it
know,
doesn't mean it's going to be like that forever.
Come on. Everybody's such a friggin' merry about
but
this
it's
stuff.
Like, but you know, American exceptionalism will come back, John. You know why?
Why?
Because we're going to build a wall.
Yeah, build the wall. it just got 10 feet higher.
Just got but, 10 feet higher.
But yeah, you know, there's a lot that I love about Sky Captain because it's just like. I feel like it's this sort of this fusion of everything I like about 40s entertainment, 30s entertainment, a little bit of 1920s, like you said.
Yeah.
Enough of the cast is good for me to overlook Paltrow's pretty phoned-in performance.
I don't think it does any real harm to the movie.
Yeah.
It doesn't really add anything to it, though.
No, she's just kind of there.
Like, they're going for... Like, I think if they had a better actress, you really could have gotten that Howard Hawks, like, banter, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because she does not do it well at all.
No, she doesn't, but they're going for that, you know?
Yeah. She probably thinks Howard Hawks is some Indian guy that died at Wounded Knee.
which was a mass shooting, by the way. Did you know?
Right. That was a mass shooting. That's still the biggest mass shooting.
It's the biggest mass shooting in American history.
It is. And you know why? They're trying to take guns away from them.
Oh, yes.
Disarming,
That was called gun grabbing.
Yeah, that's gun grabbing. I watched a film and it kind of makes me wish Hollywood were more consistent like that. And I think it's a damn... artistic tragedy that the Conrans haven't made more movies. It's sad.
Yeah, it is, and you know, because this is the kind of movie we should be getting one of, like, pretty regularly. You know,
right? I mean, there should be a Conran film every 2 years,
but
you know, in different genres.
Did
you see the short film Gumball on Vimeo?
No, but I read about it. I was reading about it in the article, and I was like, okay, I need to watch that. I watched their demo reel for John Carter, but
I watched that
Gumball.
Too. Did you watch the original Sky Captain 6-minute short they did?
I haven't seen it in a long time. I mean,
it's on the DVD. It's amusing. It's so some things they do a little more amusing. Like they imply you're just going to see this huge squadron go against the robots, which you don't really see. But you know, you can see how it sold it. But the feature length film, I just, you know, warms my heart. It's like, yeah, finally somebody made a movie for a lunatic like me.
And, you know, and Kerry Conran's implied that he has projects in the works, that he may be making another film, but who knows? I mean, he's had a lot of projects fall through.
Seems like I don't know how they survive. It's like, did they make enough money to
worked on other things. I know Kevin Conran does a lot of design work for companies, like for like TV and stuff.
Right.
Like he does a lot of costume production concepts.
So he's basically like Jim Steranko.
Yeah, like Jim
Steranko could have been the biggest name in design and movies and everything, and he only just took a few projects here and there and did a lot of secret trade work that he was paid for.
And you know, I think Carrie's done some commercials and you know, they've both been doing work. They're not like, you know, they haven't been just like, oh well, back to my hole, you know?
Right.
Although they are from Flint, Michigan, so who knows?
Yeah, no telling there.
Yeah.
But it's just like, the Gumball short is amusing. Mm-hmm. It's nothing great. It's not super innovative, but it is amusing. It shows they're still playing around with technology.
Yeah.
They basically integrated this robot character into like an old musical clips and stuff, and it actually works really well.
Yeah, I mean, they're definitely like, because Conran's definitely a mind that was thinking ahead, and like in terms of innovating film technology, you know, definitely, which definitely caught the respect of innovators like Lucas and Cameron and people who are always looking to see what they can do with the medium.
Right.
You know, whether or not you like their movies, they've always tried to like do something in a movie like they've never done before.
Do you like this image of Cameron now as like this, he's like the skinny Harry Knowles. Like, he's always getting quoted on what he thinks about the latest science.
I know, person. Like, he's like, oh, I hated the new Star Wars and stuff like that. It's like, who gives a shit?
You know? It's like, I never saw Avatar.
Yeah, it's like, Avatar wasn't, I mean, and again, Avatar, he was trying to do something new, but it's not a very good movie. That's the problem. It's not like Sky Captain, which did something new, and it was really good. The problem is, because it didn't make a ton of money, a lot of people forget what it did.
Exactly. Well, filmmakers remember it.
They do.
And cult movie fans remember it, because I think it has a following.
It does.
But it's among people who probably knew exactly what it was paying tribute to.
Yes.
But I really think, like, if you're listening to this and you're one of those types and you're a lot younger than us, but you're like, man, I love TCM. I love watching the old movies. You need to watch this.
Like, watch it and use it as a guidepost to watch older stuff. Because, like, a lot of the stuff John talks about, I haven't seen.
Yeah.
Like, I've seen some of it, but not most of it. I'm like, oh, I haven't seen that, you know? So, right. I need to go back and watch stuff, because I'm still pretty on the young end of all this.
Right. And this is basically the stuff I regularly watch. I've kind of decided I'm really not into new movies at all. Stu has come around in my way of thinking.
Oh, well, I'm with you, because I hardly saw any movies last year.
Right.
I've hardly seen any
movies. Good for you, young man.
Yes. Although I did just see Neon Demon. Mwah. Delicious.
Good. I'm looking forward to that. That guy makes very interesting movies to me.
So fucking.
I'm probably gonna love it.
It's very. So. It's very like much like a 70s Italian horror movie. But
oh, I can't wait.
And Keanu Reeves, hilarious in it.
See, that guy makes the funniest movies to me.
Yeah.
I mean, he does. Like, Only God Forgives is hysterical.
Oh, he's hilarious. He's hilarious and menacing at the same time in this movie.
Yeah, like, it's just
he's scary and funny. Like,
dude, I was laughing my ass off at Only God Forgives.
Yeah.
I was probably the only one in the theater. I was laughing at stuff. I don't think
I want to watch Only God Forgives again after watching Neon Demon.
Yeah,
which I want to go see again in the theater. Like, I liked it that much.
Oh, really? That's a high recommendation.
But it is like if somebody were to see it and say, "Yeah, I hated that," I'd be like, I can't blame you, because it's pretty disgusting and transgressive. but that's part of what
I
loved about watching.
I like it when movies get that type of reaction.
Oh, it was great. Like, no, there was something happening in the movie where it has one of those moments where you kind of go, is what I'm worried about is going to happen, about to happen. And then you go, oh, crap, it's happening. And me and my friends in the theater were just squirming and, like retching and having the best time.
Yeah, and the funny thing about that guy is he's just like this family man who collects like Doctor Who Dalek toys.
Oh, Nick Winding Refn.
Yes.
Yeah. He seems like a normal, like,
he's totally normal. That's the funny thing about it. Like, I heard that he bought a bunch of Andy Milligan film prints off of Jimmy McDonough, the guy who wrote like the Neil Young biography. I wrote the Andy Milligan biography, and like he's a weird, interesting collector like that. Like, he goes for like the odd stuff, but apparently, he's just like some normal guy has Dalek toys on his desk. He's just like, it's a big Doctor Who. It's just weird.
Yeah, it's just like, this is what you're into?
Yeah,
not it's like murder.
You know? Yeah, Ronan Rowe was telling me, because he's really into the movie Only God Forgives, because he saw it as an old
Testament. Oh, I remember he was obsessed with it when it came out.
Oh, he read the original script, and he said in the script, the police captain, the Thai police captain, was watching Westerns on TV constantly.
Oh my gosh.
Like,
I need to watch that again. I have the Blu-ray. I need to watch. I've seen it twice.
I love that movie. It's always on one of the streaming channels.
And that was hated when it came out, just like Neon Demon.
People fucking despised it. And when I told them I liked it, they thought I was fooling.
They wanted people. Well, and they wanted it to be Drive 2. That's what they wanted. And they
I like Drive, but I like Only God Forgives as well. It's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, I like them both. They're two different movies. But they Nick Winding Refn, Neon Lights, and Ryan Gosling. They wanted Drive 2.
I liked his Viking movie he did.
Oh, I love it. Valhalla Rising?
Yeah, that's a really good Viking film. Yeah, probably more like what it was really like.
And I think Fear X is a better David Lynch movie than a lot of David Lynch movies.
David Lynch is not David Lynch anymore.
No, he's not. It was a better David Lynch movie than Inland Empire. That's for sure.
Yeah, I heard that's awful. I've never seen it.
It's not good.
I just don't have the interest.
And the Pusher trilogy, also very good.
I've never seen it. Is that available anywhere? Like,
I have it on DVD, but as far as streaming, it's been on Netflix before.
Mm.
But so it's probably out there somewhere. I wonder if it's on.
I gotta look for those. I've never seen those.
Let's see, Amazon. It's on Amazon. Well, you can rent it. There's a remake of Pusher. I wouldn't recommend that because it's pretty straightforward.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen that in stores.
It's basically the same movie, and I would just watch the original.
Right.
But the original, you have the original, and then Mads Mikkelsen is in the original, but his character's the main character in Pusher 2. And there's a side character in Pusher 1 who's the main character in Pusher 3. So it's one of it's kind of this gangster saga where it's kind of like how this minor character in Yakuza Papers in Battles Without Honor and Humanity is the main character in Number 2, you know?
Right.
It's kind of doing that type of thing.
The kind of interconnected crime saga thing.
Yeah, it is, and it's really good. It's really worth watching. Like,
I'll have to try to track those down.
Yeah, you dig them. Maybe we should do them on the show sometime.
Yeah, that'll make an interesting show.
Yeah.
More.
But anyway,
Downloads than YNT.
Yes, exactly. I haven't checked that. I need to look.
Hey, it's actually doing really well.
I'm sure. There's probably a lot of fans out there. When I was in Memphis, I found Black Cat and Mean Streak on vinyl.
Oh, Black Tiger?
Black Tiger, sorry. That's what I meant.
Come on. How could you forget? Black Tiger! Tiger!
Tiger! I don't know why I said Black Cat. I was just thinking of the cover.
Yeah, the cover looks like a black cat.
But. Yeah, it doesn't really look like a tiger. But I found Mean Streak and Black Tiger on vinyl when I was there, and The Damned's Phantasmagoria. But
man, you had a lucky mining there.
I know, it was like
a little lucky as Scheme calls it, crate digging.
Yeah, it was. I was digging. I found The Damned's Phantasmagoria, I was like, oh my gosh! I was like, that can't be an easy one to find used. You know,
mackerel. But yeah, Sky Captain is really, just to get back to it, so we can say we covered Sky Captain.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, man, it had me right after I finished watching it. I was like, okay, I gotta watch a Republic serial. So I opened up Jungle Girl and started watch like the first.
Yeah,
eight chapters.
I saw your Facebook post. You were like, which do I watch? You
know? Jungle Girl or Jungle Queen? Yeah. Well, both are highly praised Republic Jungle Woman serials. So it's like, they're two of their best, and I was like, I couldn't decide, but I went with Jungle Girl, and it's a blast. It's like, this is what I don't like about stuff like Sharknado,
Yeah, well, because it's all smug. It's all like it's all above it, you know.
Right. It's like, why do they waste their time making something that's smarmy and is aimed more at the TMZ crowd? Debbie Gibson and Tiffany will catfight in this film while a giant whale is, you know, walking around the city or whatever the hell they come up with. You know, right. It's bullshit. It's like, they're so insulting, stupid, and cheap. When I know damn well these filmmakers could be making their own modern-day versions of Republic serials with real stunt work in minimal sets, you don't need a ton, use a CGI to create lost cities and jungles and stuff, and just do straightforward adventure films.
But that doesn't go viral, John. That doesn't become a meme.
That's the problem, is everything's like a YouTube bullshit. It's like, it's going to be torrented anyway. Who cares? You know, make something good that people actually want to support and think they'll actually watch again in 5 years.
So what would you give Sky Captain?
I give it about a 9.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I'm not saying it's Godfather 2 masterpiece.
Oh, no, but that's a good, solid rating.
I really, really, really enjoy watching this film. I think it's a delight. It's sort of a, It's sort of like a ice cream sundae for guys like me that actually dig all this old stuff. Yeah. Which isn't everybody. And, you know, a lot of people will watch it and have total problems with it and not get into the narrative or not understand it. And I think the more familiar you are with old entertainment, the more you're going to dig it. Because, you know, I got fellow fans. They read Doc Savage paperbacks. They listen to the old radio shows. Watch old movies all the time. Quote Howard Hawks dialogue. They love this movie, mm-hmm. too. You know, they watch those Fleischer Brothers Superman shorts. They're just, this is the way to go.
Well, and I agree. I give it an 8. I think it's a good, solid movie. If you haven't seen it, it's well worth your time. You can get the DVD for like $1, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's not expensive. And as I've often said, I am a 1940s kid trapped in a Gen Xer's body. So, you know.
Hey, you know what? We've got to bring back dads from the 70s. Isn't that right? I'm
going to wear wide collars and plaid blazers.
It just shows that I am a proud boy.
Yes. <It's> like... But yeah, I dig the film.
Me too.
I would say, hell, splurge for the Blu-ray, even if you haven't seen it.
Yeah, go ahead and get the Blu-ray, yeah, for sure.
But I think it's totally underrated and doesn't, you know, hopefully the Conrans will make something again. Kerry Conran is a really, really talented guy and got some actual vision, you know.
Both of those guys, Kerry and Kevin, because Kevin did a lot of the design for it and stuff.
Yeah, it's just really good, real talents there. Let's hope that they get another shot. You know, hell, give them a pulp property like the Spider or something. Maybe they could do something really thrilling.
Right.
You know, a lot of that actually reminded me of the.
Let them do another Phantom movie. There you go.
Oh man, that would rule.
Yes.
Well, me and Stu would be totally for that.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right, so let's wrap it up. MidnightMovieCowboys.com. You can find us on iTunes. You can find us at thephantomsway.com every Monday.
Yeah.
And be sure to like and review. I mean, rate us and review us on iTunes if you want to support the show. You know, not asking you to donate, but that helps. That helps get more listeners. So please, if you like the show, go do that.
It's probably better than donating to Zach Braff's latest crowdfunding.
Yes, it is.
You will actually get a good result out of it.
And you'll remember, and you know, when you see the movie he makes, you remember that Garden State really wasn't that good.
Yeah, exactly.
You were just in college at the time and
enough
kind of impressionable.
Enough of this mumblecore shit. Let's get back to work, America. Let's be great again.
MAGA.
Yeah.
And with that, build the wall and adios.
And mahalo.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast. To leave feedback and show suggestions, email us at midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like our Midnight Movie Cowboys show page on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at MMCowboys.
Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and feel free to leave us a review. Listen to us on Stitcher.com or the Stitcher Radio app. Want to help the show out? Visit MidnightMovieCowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate link. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Our personal links are on the right side of our homepage. See y'all next time.